Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this. I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
Tension mounts some more. Two out in the tenth. 5-4 Red Sox. Ray Knight at first. Kevin Mitchell at third. 2-2 to Mookie Wilson. Coming over, he will not have a play. 5-5 in a delirious 10th inning. Line drive foul. Can you believe this ball game at Shea?
Oh, brother.
So the winning run is at second base with two out, 3-2 to Mookie Wilson. Little roller up along first, behind the band, it gets through Buckner, here comes Knight and the Mets win it! If one picture is worth 1,000 words, you have seen about 1,000,000 words. But more than that, you have seen an absolutely bizarre finish to Game 6 of the 1986 World Series. The Mets are not only alive, they are well, and they will play the Red Sox in Game 7 tomorrow.
Can I get a witness?
Culture Vulture. The number to call to join me here in hell is 646-478-4847. I was going to attempt the Skype experiment this week, and about 20 minutes ago, I had the FUBAR Skype experience. You know, I'm very technically reluctant. If you've listened to the show for 5 minutes, you know I rail against my computer every time I get on this dopey thing. And almost anything that can go wrong will go wrong when it comes to me and a computer anyway. That's why, you know, we touched on it last week with Rushkoff about how the only option we have in our humdrum, meaningless, tedious lives to to sort of transcend the rigors of human existence is to jump into this second life, this digital world, this simulated universe, this programmable, you know, data sphere that we can get into here on technology. And as you've seen over the last couple of days with the iPhone coming up lame with their antenna problems, and, you know, there's always a freaking glitch. And, you know, we're human, but the technology isn't. And I demand perfection. You know? Like our friend Steinbrenner, passing away yesterday. So, in tribute to him, just to start the show out, because I really didn't like the man, but I tolerated his BS from afar. But it was in the 90s, before the Yankees were, you know, the gutty-gritty, you know, 27 World Championship Yankees. When they were going through their years in the desert between 77 and 96 without a championship, Steinbrenner was a big clown, a buffoon. And Yankee fans actually celebrated when he was removed from control in the early 90s after the second sort of court case, what do you want to call it, little transgression he had, you know, hunting down the dirt on Dave Winfield. And he became a character. He became a cartoon. And I don't know. I think this just kind of sums it up. There you go.
Anyway, as I was lying in the puddle, I think I may have found a way for us to get Bonds and Griffey, and we wouldn't have to give up that much.
Well, don't tell it to me, George. Tell it to the new assistant of the general manager.
I didn't get the job.
Well, once you were dead, we couldn't just sit on our hands. We got to make a move. But you still have your old job. Of course, we'll have to dock you for the time you missed. We're running the ball club here. If I give special treatment to you, everyone will want it. Next thing you know, it's chaos. And I can tell you this. Chaos does not work for the New York Yankees. Not as long as I'm running the show.
Oh, man. And that's pretty much anyone that had a deal with him on a daily basis. And everyone's had a horrible boss. Everyone's had a horrible summer job. I'm going to play a little hook tonight, a little summertime blues here on the break. And by the way, just in case you're keeping notes, top of the hour, 10 o'clock, we're going to have our friend Mike Silva stop by for a little post-game summer show. Because tonight, here day after the All-Star game, Mike tried an experiment there at 7 o'clock on New York Baseball Digest. I think it went pretty well. He had the all-time Mets against the all-time Yankees in a Stratomatic simulated game, won by the Metsies. I'll spoiler alert. 9-5, Doc Gooden going a complete game on that one. We'll get into some of the details with Mike top of the hour. But the whole point is that, once again, reality is not enough, okay? We now live in a world we can usurp reality. We can distort it. We can change it. We can't create it. No friggin' way can we create it. Why would we want to create it? You know? I mean, really. But I mean, that's kind of like a lot of work, you ask me. Let's see if we got him here. Now, continuing along the lines of incredible reactions to Steinbrenner's death, we have the Rush Limbaugh reaction. Now, that's gotten some play today because, of course, that's what Rush do, right? He says pretty much that's what his job is to provoke us. So it's an interesting take, you know, because it's not that far off of the mainstream interpretation of George's bulliness. And everyone just blows it off now, of course, because he's gone. And he did other things. And no life is complete. In, you know, in either extreme. I'm sure Hitler was nice to dogs, you know. But it's like, when you're dealing with Steinbrenner, he represented the man. He never wanted the man to win. It was only in his older years that he became this cherub. So, well, let's see if we can get the Limbaugh comment up here, because it really is, you know, just kind of like, obviously, just inciting people to react. And like the lemmings we are, we did. Let's see. Here's yesterday's worst person in the world.
Sadly, for itself, George Steinbrenner has passed away at age 80. That cracker made a lot of African-American millionaires. George Steinbrenner, the classic capitalist, everybody around him became wealthy. And like most successful capitalists, he made the people around him wealthy. And a lot of African-American millionaires along the way, and at the same time, he fired a bunch of white guys as managers, left and right.
There is a time and a place for everything, and Rush Limbaugh knows neither. Rush Limbaugh, today's worst person in the world.
There you go. Okay. So, I don't know. If you guys have reactions to that, I'd love to bat that around with you a little bit, a little baseball humor. Because I think it's important that the social aspect of what he did, and if anyone's keeping score at home, you know my stuff, somaspace.org, Steinbrenner, big eco, very erratic in his behavior, right? Look at that narrative. 80 years he wrote the eco script. But now, you know, you could kind of turn a little bit on its ear because a couple days before, Bob Shepard passes away, 99, complete exo. Right? Now he gets, you know, upstaged by Steinbrenner a couple days later. I think Bob Shepard died on Sunday. Everybody was spending Monday, basically, before the All-Star game, you know, going over, oh, Jeter's going to do the announcement. Okay, boom, Steinbrenner. It's like a complete 180. Everyone, literally, there was probably, I would say, 100 hours of broadcasting yesterday in the New York area here and some of the national outlets devoted to this man. Because he was the epitome of what everybody would want to call a success in American life in the last 40 years. You know, he broke rules. He threw money at every problem. He estranged all kinds of relationships and patched them up later. You know, you live long enough, you could probably outlive a lot of your difficulties. And he alienated a lot of people that were close to him. Family, friends, managers, players, didn't matter. He's a rich guy. He's rich guy, big car. But, of course, he had a heart of gold, and he put people through college. It's amazing. That's the eco life. See, I'm living it. I'm only 45 years through it. But we have a checkered past and a checkered future. If you don't know what an eco is, I'm tired of explaining. I should probably do, you know what I'll do for you guys, since you know, the few archivers out there try to follow what I'm trying to say. I will do a minute on each of the domains for next week's show. And I will play them at intervals so that you can go, this is a philo. And I'll give you kind of a brief little overview of what they are. Because I do kind of throw that lingo out there once in a while on the show, especially when I'm talking to myself here. Because that's where I live. I live in the four domains. I live in this filter, this sort of map terrain. It's like it kind of merges the way your nervous system's wired. And everything you look at is being encoded. Everything you experience is being filtered through them. So you can't get out of the four domains. There's no door. There's no window. There's no way out. No substitute. So you can put all your technical stuff around. You can put all your simulating stuff around. You can't escape the four domains. All right, unless you're Leo DiCaprio, and that's another story. So let's see. We got anything else here going on? The BP experiment is underway tonight. I'm going to check in on that now, see if we got anything new. They're drilling. Yeah, for the relief well to start, and the experiment's going to be going on the next couple of days. I was watching before, the metaphors were flying, you know, chocolate milk, they were calling it. Yeah, let's call crude oil chocolate milk. So, you know, and again, I'm a little bit kind of bristly today because we're a week removed from a heat wave. We're going back into the heat tomorrow. It's been a brutal summer, and we're set up for a very, very, very rough winter with this crude oil being, you know, filtered down like it has been. And so, you know, this is one of those kind of like underground stories. Here we go. After delay, BP begins testing new cab over gushing oil leak. Wow, there's so much going on. So, let's see. We had the World Cup decided over the weekend while I'm looking this up. Kind of a non, you know, sequitur kind of ending, huh? You know, kind of anticlimactic. You know, Spain won, good, and goal, all that. But it wasn't drama. It wasn't any drama. When the Germans got knocked out, that was drama. BP's allied last-minute government fears of making the disaster worse began testing the new tighter-fitting cap Wednesday. Let's see if we got any news on this thing, because it's supposed to be going on tonight. And we're going to get this thing stopped as fast as we can. Day 85. All right, let's see if we can go to the updated stuff, because I want, like, live feed. Let's see. BP. News. Because there's two aspects of this. There's the physical aspect of it, right? And then there's the political stuff that goes on around it, which is amazing. Look at these images. Wow. You can't see them. All right, let's see. 9 minutes ago. From Forbes. There are more commercials. Look at this. I got pop-up ads on my pop-up ads here. Let's go, people! Steinbrenner would not tolerate this. God, I had so many bosses like him. That's why I work for myself now. And by myself. Okay, let's go down to New Orleans. BP Allies last minute. It's the same article. 9 minutes. He talking. You got Gibbs doing his little spin. Two vessels collected 700,000 gallons on Tuesday. The government estimates 1.5 million to 2.5 million are leaking every day. Oh, my God. What a winter we're going to have. As of day 85, between 92 million and 182 million gallons of oil have spewed, love that word, spewed, into the Gulf. Web reporter from Houston. Okay. There's not a lot going on here. I want to get like the updated stuff. They're working on it tonight. I want to see it. If you guys know anything, let me know. It's a story within a story to me, because there's information and then there's interpretation, and that's what gets me with this stuff. You know, and I always tell you guys that half of semantics is the environment. What's going on in the environment will be a mirror of how we're going to be functioning as a society. So when you see something like this that hasn't moved in almost 3 months, and I kind of knew they were waiting around. BP's legal blowout, when all lawsuits are in, the oil company's facing a settlement bill that will rank them on the highest of all time. I reported last week that the stock actually went up. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing we live in this kind of, like, again, this is another reality. The stock market is a reality within a reality. And it doesn't so much function on the same rules as physical reality does. And here's the live feed. Let's go over there. Let's see. The advertiser. So much going on. What is this? All right. My feet. This isn't helping me. What is this? It's like a guy from the Diamondbacks or something. It's like an all-star thing. Unsure well will be capped after feds object. I was at 1:30. There's so many political things happening around this. I don't trust any of the information that comes out of it. Any of it.
Two young men that have now been relieved of their duties, Josh and AJ.
No idea what this is. Somebody got fired? Bizarre. All right. You know, I need help. You guys got to help me out on this thing, because there's very little coming across the wire here that's explaining this to me. So please, if you're out there, hop in the chat room and let me know. I'm just completely out of my mind here with this thing. BP experiment. If there's anything going on in the news, I could find out. Not that Sean Hannity or this crazy Michelle Max Mapkin, whatever her name is going to help me out. Evil looking onto. Let's see. Rachel's talking deficits. All right, nobody's on it. You know, I need to go to Elvis.
Two things you need to know. Uh-huh. I'm the king. And number two is look out, man.
That's right. Look out, man. All right. Pretty much from an hour and a half ago, they started the tests. They don't want to make any definitive calls here. BP starts crucial test on leaking oil. Okay. This is nice. Boy, everybody wants a piece of me tonight. Want a piece of me? All right, here we are, Houston. Hello, Houston, we have a problem. BP began the process to stretch up to 48 hours, getting the green light from top U.S. officials who delayed the plan 24 hours. The Coast Guard guy that's retiring wanted a closer analysis, would not exacerbate the leak. Could you imagine if this thing backfires after we waited 85 days to get here? You know. Let's see. Rachel's up to no good. Let's see what she's up to here. We'll sell the cast. We're going to check in on the SB soon.
$1 trillion or so onto the deficit. The first thing that wasn't a tax cut in Marco Rubio's 12-point plan was repealing Obamacare, repealing health reform. You hear that from a lot of Republicans right now, including the top Republican in the House, John Boehner. If you did that, you would add another... $19 billion, you'd add another $138 billion to the deficit. The next idea from Marco Rubio was another Republican favorite, to prevent...
All right, she's just slamming all the Republicans. I'm sick of that. Anyway, the leak, which began April 20th, basically they say the tests indicate the sealing of the oil might cause even further damage. Current capping would stay in place and become part of the system to capture the oil and siphon at the ships on the surface. They've already have a relatively robust remedial program in place. Oh, boy. I think we've reached a wait-and-see point. Yeah, wait-and-see. Shares in BP ended down 2.3% in London in slow trade, or off about 1.9% in New York, with some analysts saying investors will likely cashing in profits ahead of further news on the cap. Cap. All right. Now, going 180 here for a minute. A week ago, we were anticipating the big LeBron-a-thon. And, because again, this I'm connecting some dots here, people. All right? Big dots. Big dots. Big time, big dots. Dot dots. We watched LeBron James' decision last Thursday night. Actually, it was me and Fred over here watching on TV. And the amount of reactions to it, both anticipation and then the reactions to it, you know, they're still going on, really. I mean, they're going to go on into all the way into next spring, into the basketball playoffs, but the initial reactions were mostly about his lack of political savvy dealing with the Cavaliers and the way he kind of twisted the knife with the New Yorkers, because as I was reporting last week on Wednesday, MSG stock had gone up, and there was something on the order of $20 million made, because the stock went up like 7%, anticipating he was coming to the Knicks. That, of course, went away by the end of the week, but it's that sort of, we talked about it a little bit at Rushkoff last week, it's that sort of predator mentality, that scarcity mentality, that gimme, gimme, gimme mentality, that materialistic mentality that we're so attached to in every way, shape, and form, no matter what it is. No matter what someone achieves, look at Steinbrenner's life. Now, I heard phone calls and all kinds of things this week about, you know, letters he wrote and things he did behind the scenes that were very, very eco, very, very empathic, very, very human. And then you hear some of the horrible things he did business-wise to screw people over, and was just a conniving guy. And you know, skinflint with some of his employees and things like that in an effort to rule by fear. And it's like, as long as it's not your boss, you're fine. But you always notice how, because it was a means to an end, it had that Machiavellian, you know, sort of ethos to it, that everyone put up with him. What are you going to do? He's an elephant with his foot on your throat. And if you're dealing with a bully, whether it's a boss, a government, a healthcare system gone corrupt, an educational system that's completely incompetent and is just so stagnant, all of these too big to fail things, right? You got to get back to the soma and squirrel all that stuff and go inside your breath where they can't get you. Can't get you. Close your eyes and find your feet. And I've dealt with people that are millionaires, and I've dealt with people that are paupers. Okay, in 20 years of doing this dopey job, I've seen every type of sape that walks the planet. The knuckle dragon morons. I've seen the PhDs with 9 letters after their names. You know what? When I ask them to close their eyes and breathe, they're all the same. Okay? Your nervous system is uniform in its design in that way. And then you, as a individual, evolving and moving towards your path, remodel that nervous system, and the plasticity comes out, and all the little nuances that make you you come out based on the way you interact with your environment, right? So I say BP to a banker, always wanted to be a banker, and their reaction is the government's oppressing the corporations. I can't believe they're doing this. The regulators are on my butt, and they feel oppressed, right? I say BP to someone who's living on the in the Gulf, and they're in a paradox because they made their money off of oil, indirectly or directly, and now they're being poisoned. So, and then they don't have a job. So how do you think you're going to deal with that one? So that's the social stress that I'm trying to help you out with on the show. Put out these issues, put out these different things. So here's LeBron. This is such a horrible thing. This poor little Philo, he just wanted to go home to mommy, but he had to go to Miami. Not mommy.
The answer to the question everybody wants to know. LeBron, what's your decision?
This fall, man, it's very tough. And this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
Miami Heat. That was the conclusion you woke up with this morning.
That was the conclusion I woke up with this morning.
Yeah. Pack of BS, he woke up with it this morning. The fallout from his statement last Thursday night, as a television event, another reality show that we didn't need. They've talked about is LeBron's image. He can't be Jordan now. He can't be this. He can't be that, because of the way he did this, and because he's a philo, he tried to please everybody else, boys and girls clubs, his corporate people, his inner circle, and he basically ran away from home. And of course, Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cavaliers, writes this horrible letter and basically paints him out as being a coward. And he gets fined by the league $100,000, and the fans go, "Oh, we're going to pay your fine." And that amount of, just extra is all we're left with now. With the actual event, if you mind mapped it out, the actual event is like a little dot in the middle of this giant mind map of all these different ideas, these subtext ideas, these things that are sort of operating above it, sort of like weather, and they attract attention. And where attention goes, there's going to be a sale, right? So whether you're burning LeBron's old jersey or whether you're buying his new one, doesn't matter. The show's going on, and they got you. So if you take that real event and then you put it into a video game, which we're going to get into here in a minute, and my lack of capacity to play video games, it doesn't work for me on any of these levels, whether it's sports or these other, killing machine games. And we get another option to go into for our reality. So if real life isn't enough, we can go into the computer and we can watch YouTube. We can do things like that. We can do things like Box Talk Radio. We can go away from the physical world and go into this technological world that we created, and we could actually have a lot of the aesthetics that we can't get here just accessorized to the hilt. And that's why we love this stuff. That's why we go to the movies. That's why we watch the sporting events. That's why we buy into the BS on the reality shows. That's why we watch the stupid hills. It's because entertainment is catnip for brains. You don't have to think. You just have to show up and be stimulated, and then you're gone. Now, there was a study, and I don't know if I can find it right here on my Facebook. On the Facebook, yeah, on my social platform. That's I'm using everything here. Pete Sky of Pants on Fire. I think it was him. Maybe it was Malolo. Somebody that finally demonstrated that television does literally rot your brain. See if I can find that little study here. And they're all over the diets again. Enough with the diets. Brain shrunk that lift man like the personality. Where's that television article? This is a gaming one. We'll go there first, I guess, about playing video games and what it does to your attention. You know, and again, I'm a kid that grew up with, you know, Atari and you know, Space Invaders. So I'm not someone who you know, spent a lot of time playing video games as a kid. It was Wiffle Ball and Strat-O-Matic, which I was a dice baseball guy. Strat-O-Matic was kind of slow. I did play the electric football game, though. Kind of pointless game. All right, here we go. Study: kids' gaming is strongly associated with attention problems, all right? Concern for parents regarding their kids' gameplay habits is nothing new, but a new study published by the Official Journal of American Academy of Pediatrics strongly suggests that children who play a lot of video games might actually be doing a quantifiable harm to their attention spans. The survey, which followed 1,323 elementary school students over a year, found that those who play the games more than 2 hours a day, 2 hours, playing about 12 hours, are 67% more likely to have attention problems in home and in the classroom. In a similar correlation, studies around television consumption was the same. Television consumption, like your sensory diet, see? One hypothesis under investigation is that the media, like TV and games, are stimulating enough to young minds that they reduce their ability to remain engaged in the real world. Really? Have you gone to a college classroom lately? Others have hypothesized that because most television programs involve rapid changes in focus, frequent exposure to television may harm the child's ability to sustain focus on tasks that are not inherently attention-grabbing. I don't know. See if I still have it on here. I don't know if I do, but I'm going to double check. See if I have, I doubt it. God, you know, this thing eats up all my clips. I wanted to play the SpongeBob Imagination, but you get this instead.
Boozy, boozy, bop, city bop.
That's it. So anyway, and further researchers admit it's tough to argue that a child able to remain engaged with video games, which often requires persistence, repetitive behaviors, and focus on motor skill tasks, has focus and attention problems. So this is weird. Let's see. What's this guy saying? The study concedes it can only prove correlation, not causation. The study's lead author, Iowa State doctoral candidate Edward Swing, says an issue of relationship between media and distractibility, rather than a fact that kids... Right, the fact that games on or television definitely degrade kids' ability to pay attention. Wouldn't surprise me if children who have attention problems are attracted to these media and that these media increase their attention problems, okay? So let's see. And further, researchers admit, this is what confused me, it's tough to argue that a child able to remain engaged with video games, be a zombie, which often requires persistence, repetitive behaviors, and focus on motor skill tasks. It's very exo to play video games. Or watch DVDs. It's a monotask. Has focus and attention problems. Further researchers needed to suggest to explore the difference between types of attention required for media and the type required for kids in academic and household settings. Ah, the flavors of attention. Love it. A smaller simultaneous study of college students found that those who consume more than 2 hours of TV and games are twice as likely to have attention problems. That's what they said. They're repeating themselves. Stein doesn't like that. These students have entered interactive approaches to existing issues that led them to spend blocks of time on media instead of classwork during a period of life when schedules are rigorous. Nonetheless, because of the cumulative later life effect, the study recommended that parents limit their TV under 2 hours, the best chance. Are you kidding me? The parents encourage the TV use because the kid is basically off the street. Ugh. Gotta be kidding me. You know, I look around and I don't like what I see.
It could be worse, though at least we're not Detroit! We're not Detroit!
So there you go. There's your BP, Postal LeBron, Steinbrenner Limbaugh update. We've covered it all in a half hour here. There's a couple of studies in here on Pete Sky, Pants on Fire is the thing that I saw. But the TV one was the one I was interested in, I guess. Yeah. There's so much going on with the brain that we don't apply it very much. We sort of just kind of report it and not know how to deal with it, because if the more you understand about the brain, and I'm going to get into a little reality testing here in a minute with you guys, the more you get into core assumptions, things that you need, as Paul Rapp, one of the predominant brain researchers down at the University of Pennsylvania, told me once, Flippy, you got to believe the bullshit that keeps you sane. You start removing that, and you have a personal anarchy that goes on, because your belief system is more important to your well-being than your nervous system. You can have a completely fried nervous system. Say you're, you're Stephen Hawking, right? You know, you're not the most healthy character in the world, but you have a very, very healthy belief system. It's got a lot of flexibility. It's got a lot of complexity. It can adapt to a lot of situations. It has a big, deep understanding of its existence in the cosmos. Very powerful neuroception in that exo, right? He's able to really categorize almost everything that happens to him in a very rich and organizing and compelling way. Whereas you get someone who has a very flimsy belief system, but maybe is, you know, athletically endowed or, has a little financial chutzpah, has some other resources, and the slightest thing knocks them right off their keisters. And it's back to rehab for them, right? Why? Right? This goes back to the Antonovsky principle of the sense of coherence. It's something to play when I say that. There's nothing. There's absolutely nothing in this dopey thing. Except Elvis.
What the fuck was he talking about?
Yeah. The sense of coherence principle basically says that you get hit in the head with a cold fish. Unk. You know, life just knocks you on your ass. Now, some of us get back up to a standing eight count and go on fighting. Some of us are just down for the count. What determines that resilience is your sense of coherence. And that is basically characterized by three things. How meaningful your life is, right? How understandable or comprehensible your life is, and how manageable your life is at any point in time. So you look at this LeBron James thing from a philo perspective. What's important to a philo? I'll tell you. Consistency, continuity, family, loyalty, status quo. They don't like change, right? Being a follower, being a good teammate. All these things are important to him. Now, he has thrust upon himself the image of being an Anto, the king, the leader, the decider, decision water. These are all signatures he had to develop outside of his core identity, outside of the way he's been wired. So he's right there at 25 years old. He's just about to get an adult brain. And someone slips this thing into the narrative and says,
LeBron, yes, we'd like to go with the Anto theme, please.
He doesn't know how to do it. So he hems and he haws and he hems and he haws and he goes and hides out in Akron. He has a big circle all around him. He's got people spinning all over the place, right? He runs away from home. He runs away from the Cavaliers. He runs away from his home state. He's trying to go through the rebellion that happens during adolescence, the natural rebellion, the rejection of the parents, going out into the world of adulthood. I'm going to do it myself, Mama. I'm going to do it myself. Whoa, I need Dwayne Wade and Bosh and Riley and, you know, all these other people around me, because of the fact that he was a people pleaser. What was the first thing this SOB said when he got to Florida? It's like family down here. It's like family. So did he say that? You just go, oh, my God, just bartender, please. He's just running the philo script. He couldn't be Papa Bear for the Knicks. He couldn't be Papa Bear for the Bulls. He couldn't even be Papa Bear for the Cavaliers. So he took his boo-boo bear, you know, and a new yogi, he took that to Florida. Now, contrast that with eco-face Steinbrenner, right, who for the last 5 years has been on IV drip down in Tampa, but still managed to you know, steer the boat enough from the back of it as an eco would, you know, with one eye on the other world and one eye on this world, and he got Tory out of there, another philo, thrown to the side of the bus. You know, he gets Cashman in there, you know, relentless exo to make all the contract stuff. He's a complete viper. And he gets Joe Girardi, an Anto Pitbull, to run the team. And, of course, he had to rein in his dopey eco son, Hal Steinbrenner, who was, you know, chain-smoking and making stupid comments. And he made sure that the other Steinbrenner, although Hank, I mean Hank's the eco, and Hal, the guy that's actually lucid, the Onto Steinbrenner, is running the show. So basically, you have a complete menage there of all four domains within the Steinbrenner situation, right? You got the exiting manager Tori, the Philo, the loyal guy who put up with the crap and basically, you know, was treated badly. What did Tori talk about when he called up Steinbrenner on his birthday this year? These Yankee years, it was like family. It's just such a, oh, God, why are we so freaking sensitive to that stupid word? It just means permission to be dysfunctional. That's all it means, family. Permission to be dysfunctional. Oh, it's just family. We're all connected. Until it's time to just cut your throat and throw you to the side of the road and give you a horrible contract after you didn't make the playoffs for a couple of years. Do you seriously think that Joe Torre wouldn't have won the World Series last year with that team, with the three free agents? Come on, please, please, Nigeria, please. Maybe we'll get into that little simulated reality with our friend Silva here, top of the hour. So you have the Philo and Torre, right? You have the Eco and George Steinbrenner, right? You have the Onto and Joe Girardi, and you have the Exo and Cashman. Now you also had another Exo coming in. Mattingly, another guy who yesterday spent a lot of time pontificating about the great George Steinbrenner, who again ran him into the ground during the 80s, ran him into the ground, tried to make him into an Onto. What the hero in all of these scenarios is always the Onto. The Onto assumes the leadership role naturally. Jordan, Kobe, right? Peyton Manning. You know, all these guys are natural leaders. The Jeter, the Jeterian, the captain. Did you watch him yesterday talking about Steinbrenner? He's my friend. He was your boss. He gave you millions. He was my friend. You know, I gotta find that commercial. That's actually a funny one. Is Jeter on with the American Express card? That is some funny stuff. Because it wasn't that long ago, before A-Rod was, you know, sort of the focus, that Jeter's activities at night were something of a concern for Mr. Steinbrenner. So I think it was a Visa commercial. But it was funny. And, you know, Gina never gets caught doing anything. Nothing. Here we go. 30-second commercial. God, this is an old commercial. Look how young Gina looks there.
Come on in, Derek. I thought we'd discuss this thing and have it all worked out. You're our starting shortstop. How can you possibly afford to spend two nights dancing, two nights eating out, and three nights just carousing with your friends? Oh.
If you want to enjoy the New York nightlife, bring your Visa card. Because Orson, Cheetah, and the Broom Street Bar don't take American Express. Visa, it's everywhere you want to be.
There you go. And then the conga line dancing at the end. Oh, man. It's pretty funny. I that is just classic Steinbrenner right there. He made so many commercials like that that he was a consummate character. He was like a wrestling villain. Oh, man, I hate him. Oh, Steinbrenner. God, dopey eco. So, all right, let me get into this reality testing here before we get our friend on the show here for a minute, because there was an article a couple days ago that was kind of slipped under the radar with all these things, LeBron and all these things happening that are so important to everybody, that I kind of like, well, you know, the scientist takes on gravity, says gravity doesn't exist. I read that article. I don't know why. You know, I'm a little silly in the head, I guess. And the guy makes a case that gravity, one of the primary forces of nature, is an emergent property of time and space. We're living in a hologram! Hologram! And the guy proves it with a bunch of fancy math. Now, of course, nobody's going to back him up yet. Because what the heck would that mean? Who's going to pay their taxes? Who's going to pay their EasyPass bill if this is the case? We said last week, you know, I actually found it after the show. There's a dude. Let me see if I can find why I'm so eco right now. So eco. Oh. Great. And the article's not there anyway. You got to register for the New York Times. Like, I already freaking downloaded it, you bastards. So I will show you. Let's see. I'll try it this way. There was a quote last week that I found after the show talking to Rushkoff about things. Let's see, I got to go to the email here. Where is it? Interesting. Can't seem to find the old Eudora when you need it. Ye old Eudora. Oh, I think I see Mike. Making a hard left here. From Gravity to Silva. All right, let's go Silva. I just saw him pop up there. I'll give him this introduction.
Anyway, as I was lying in the puddle, I think I may have found a way for us to get Bonds and Griffey, and we wouldn't have to give up that much.
Well, don't tell it to me, George. Tell it to the new assistant of the general manager.
I didn't get the job.
Well, once you were dead, we couldn't just sit on our hands. We got to make a move. But you still have your old job. Of course, we'll have to dock you for the time you missed. We're running a ball club here. If I give special treatment to you, everyone will want it. Next thing you know, it's chaos. And I can tell you this. Chaos does not work for the New York Yankees. Not as long as I'm running the show.
There he is. All right, so let's pop up our friend here. Let's see if I can find the switchboard. I know there's Minaj. Mike Silva from New York Baseball Digest.
Hey, is George Costanza the Yankees version of Howard McDell running for GM? Is that the way it works?
I think we're going to degenerate to that eventually with this summer of love he's going through here.
Mm-hmm.
But
hey, listen, I compared his primaries to save. I said you're having some easy times. I mean, his closest race was 52-46. He's got high approval ratings. His approval ratings are better than Jerry's. The last time I looked on NYBD when we did a little presidential approval rating for Jerry, so he's doing something right. You know, I should maybe try to put out some primaries out there. I don't know if I'd have quite the same amount of success as Howard.
My problem with it is that, in case you guys aren't aware, my show is that Howard McDell, I guess
McDell for
primary,
GM, McDell for yeah. GM.com.
Yeah, his primary website, I guess, would still be. You know, that one, I guess, for this effort. But he's a regular contributor to New York Baseball Digest on the show, and he contributes on the site, of course. And he's writing a book, I guess, about all this stuff.
Yeah, there's going to be a book about it. Yep, maybe that's
yeah.
an experience.
And he's running for GM against nobody on all these baseball
blogs. He's succeeding Omar.
To succeed Omar. Omar would be the incumbent here.
Yes.
And he's going for this primary run. He's making it because he's got a big political wonk thing going on. But
it
kind of cracks me
up. I think he used to work on John Kerry's campaign. If I'm not mistaken, I'd have to get that. He was involved in politics for a while.
I think he supported
John Edwards in 2004.
Yeah, he's definitely a triple threat. I mean, he's a Met fan, he's a liberal, And he has a certain let's just call it an edge to him that if you hear him, you read him, you can't be in the middle with Howard. You're going to be for him or against him. And I don't know if he's just because he's going to the blogs that are familiar with him. And we're going to get into a little bit of the stat geek backlash too. Is that you know when you're dealing with a baseball team, the fan base is a continuum where you have the passionate kind of radical fan. That is just a pom-pom waver, and you have the uber, you know, analytical fan that is hypercritical of the team,
or
no matter what.
Basically
always going to see the glass half empty, and no matter what the team does, and just talking about it before the beginning of the show, Steinbrenner sort of embodied the entire spectrum because he was so good at making victory unsatisfactory. It wasn't good enough when they won the World Series. It was 15 minutes later, what are we going to do for next year? He never seemed to let anybody rest. And I remember that.
But the core four doesn't seem to be worse off for it. Like, that's the thing, I guess, where the disconnect is. You know, you and I could say that. And I think the mentality that you describe is more detrimental to the fan base than to the players. Because I think the players actually need that to keep them going. Because with 162 games and playoffs and the money they make, and I think that's the hard part to – I mean, no matter how many times we could say we could see $30 million a year in the paper, and you know, I was talking to a baseball writer the other day. He said, really, the sports writing, and I'm guilty of this, it's not really about the game. We've talked about this on your show. It's about contracts and salary and you know, all sorts of things that have nothing to do with the X's and O's. But until you really put in perspective what $30 million a year is, you have no idea how hard it might, you know, you can say, oh, woe is them. But after you've got that contract, what's the motivation to win? You know, what's the motivation to push yourself that third or fourth at bat on a hot Sunday afternoon? I mean, you know, I was hurting. I have bone spurs up the yin-yang because I was playing softball. I had a fourth at bat in an 11-2 game on Sunday. I'm not getting paid anything for this. I got that at bat out of there quick so I could sit back down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Think about these guys who can't do in the post-amphetamine era. So I think that's where what you describe is more detrimental to the fans because I never got the sense winning is enjoyment, winning is relief, winning is entitlement. And I don't think they understand how rare what the Yankees have done and how fortunate they are. I don't think the fan base understands that because they look at someone like me, well, you're a Mets fan. How can you enjoy that team? And there's times you don't, but I also understand, you know, that winning is a process. It's not an entitlement.
Getting to the politics and economics, that's the underbelly of the entertainment part of it, the fan part of it. If you take the block of time, you know, early 90s to now, when George's return and he gave up control and he let Stick and Showalter kind of, you know, basically you know, evolved the infrastructure that became the late 90s.
Stick said it best. He said on a fan the other day, he thinks, and Stick is a humble guy, he thinks what he brought to the table is he taught George patience.
Yeah, well, George had no choice at that point.
Yeah,
he was humble.
Look,
he was
George,
humble to a degree.
George would have been suspended, but you know what? No one's going to tell me that he didn't have some kind of idea what was going on. I mean,
no.
Jim Key was signed when he was out. Jim Abbott was traded for. I mean, there was some.
He did something. He drove Torrey crazy.
I don't necessarily think that he was completely out of the loop on the entire thing.
I think
so.
He was involved with the return of the Giambino and all. He started doing it again as soon as they lost one World Series. I mean, A-Rod. I mean,
exactly.
So he was still around. But if you take that block of time, you compare it to the run that say the 49ers went on from the early 80s to the mid 90s before DeBartolo got knocked out of there. Same thing. You know, charismatic owner. Hall of Famers all over the place, Core Four, whatever you want to call it, with Montana and Rice and Taylor and these guys. And as that, I mean, it wasn't death that part of them. It was fraud and court cases and stuff made them sell the team. But when a dynasty comes full circle, when you put it into context, when you look at the Yankees franchise, because they are such a signature franchise of Major League Baseball,
right.
do you look at the era of the post-World War II Yankees, the DiMaggio Yankees, up to the 64 Yankees, and you look at the 20-year cycle we're in now, again, ownership, those things weren't a big deal. That Yankee team didn't draw as much. They just won. And because baseball was so much more of a layman's sport, those guys weren't getting paid a lot, that it just seemed to me that run had a more talented base, because it was a smaller league, you know, and you were competing against the same guys over and over and over again, and it was just you won your league and you played the World Series. And in the last 15 years, with all the other things that have come in, wild cards and all the other stuff, is it, and of course the steroid era. Do you look at those two things culturally and say, okay, here's the Stone Age Yankees that went on that 15-20 year run, and here's the Jetson Yankees, you know, that went on this 15-20 year run. Could Steinbrenner have owned the other team and gotten as much out of them?
It's tough. I mean, just such a different era. I mean, they had advantages that even today, with all their money power, they don't. There was no draft back then. There's territorial rights. They could pretty much get whoever they wanted and come on through the system. There was no free agency. You know, I think the guy just had such a yearning to win that no matter what he did, he would have found a way in that era to make it work.
I'm just trying to picture Steinbrenner in an era when there's three baseball teams in New York and all those newspapers.
Yeah, but it's also different media time. I don't necessarily. I mean, it's hard for me because I wasn't there. I mean, I'm just thinking about just from media time. I just look at the modern media,
mm-hmm.
and I say to myself, I say, you know, look how it is today. Well, look at the amount of attention. It's a lot harder now to get noticed. Back then, you know, it was three teams, but I think it was easier. And I think the Yankees were always the crown jewel of everything. You know, the Dodgers were kind of like their thing going on in Brooklyn, their hardcore fan base. And then you have the Giants, who are like the, they're like the forgotten.
They were the Nets, right?
They were the Islanders,
you know?
Yeah, like, you know. I had a writer from the Wall Street Journal email me and say, hey, do you know any like fan sites for the old New York Giants? You know, you hear about the Dodgers to the day. And I said, no, I really don't.
Wow.
You know?
Like gold.
So,
yeah.
What does that tell you, right? I mean,
exactly.
That tells you kind of the deal. Yeah. So it's an interesting question. I mean, I think the biggest thing is, for whatever you want to think about him, he made sure that everybody was focused on one thing, a single focus, and there was a structure and a process in place. Now, when he was at his worst was when he wouldn't adhere to people doing their job. He would interfere. He would push people in different directions. He was impetuous, and he
mm-hmm.
still was successful. And the only reason I don't think he won in the 80s is because they were probably about one or two pitchers short. I think if they had one or two pitchers, and they lucked out, I think they probably would have won it one of those years.
Even if you just had the wild card back then, they would have made the playoffs.
Yeah, it would have been a different ball game. I find it hard to believe that they would not have won. So, I don't think the 80s was as bad as everyone thinks. And they still drew pretty well. I mean, I think the Mets dwarfed them in the 80s because of what happened there, and I think that's why people don't look as fondly on there. But, you know, the guy won in three separate decades, 70s, 90s. And the turn of the century. And the big game changed immensely in all each three of those decades. And he adjusted and he won. And money had a lot to do with it, but it was also, you know, the player development and stick and getting that core full of that foundation, because those are the guys in the end that were the heart of all this. They were, you know, without Mariano, without Jeter, I just don't know how many, if they even have won one championship, much less, you know, they're on like five now, on six. So that's the way I look at it, you know.
Yeah, and again, two of those four World Series against the hated Atlanta Braves, another team that basically was a perennial, you know, playoff.
They were supposed
team,
to be
so.
The dynasty. When you think
they
about
were,
it,
exactly.
The Yankees took the Braves dynasty. I mean, the Braves won in '95. They were on the verge of winning two straight in '96.
Up 2-0.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, '95, '96, '97. I mean, if you look back. And you even think about what we just did, the whole Stratomatic thing. If you even go back to those teams statistically, 96, 97, 98, 99,
even 2000?
Especially 98. I mean, these are just really good teams. I mean, the pitching is just insane. You have good offense. Bullpen's a little spotty.
They probably average low 90s in wins, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A couple
of
years they had 100.
You know, yeah, yeah.
That's the thing. In 20 years, you'll remember the Yankees. You won't remember the Braves.
Right.
They're like the Buffalo Bills that came from the other league. They were kind of the Washington Generals, you know, for the Yankees in two World Series. And I think they swept them in the second one, right? The Yankees swept them
in the
98, right?
99, 98 was San Diego, yeah.
Not that 98 was
yeah.
It was the Braves, and then because
99 was the Braves, 98 was San Diego, and 96 was the Braves. So yeah,
okay.
and then
of course the
Mets
in
2000. Right,
yeah.
So you know,
yeah.
I think we're even at ad nauseum with George. I mean, I've heard every George story in
the
48
hours. Then we're gonna have memorials this weekend and all kinds of stuff.
Right,
it's not gonna stop.
It'll die down. I think tomorrow when the games start up again, I think it'll die down. And Joe and I'm gonna do their stat summit at 2:05. So.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that'll
right before you came on, I was fishing out a quote from last week. This economist, Adam Smith, you know, kind of an ancient guy, he had a statement that said, all money is a matter of belief. And so when you extrapolate that to what's gone on, not just within the sport of baseball, but the sports around baseball, which is a segue into the Stratomatic universe and the gaming universe,
right.
Is that the cottage industry's that have kind of like risen up in the last 30, well, the Steinbrenner era, we'll call it, you know, as technology and computers and all these things have evolved to create a lot of digital shadows of the game that didn't exist before. I mean, one of the tweets I saw last night after McCann's hit was the Fangraph change for the percentage of the American League winning right before that hit to right after.
Yeah, that's
and it's like,
thing, yeah.
This is what has created this separation to me between the fan and the game, because the money alone creates a moat around it. You mentioned the core four before, and
right.
You know, could the core four in the 50s say that? Were they that separated from their fan base? I mean, I'm sure Mickey Mantle made more than the mailman, but his connection to the fans was much, much more, you know, one standard deviation away, maybe a standard deviation and a half away than an A-Rod would be from his fan base, you know, at this point.
Right.
And so when you look at the economy then, the economy now, and the sheer numbers, I mean, last night's ratings were the worst ever for an All-Star game,
right.
You know, history of the All-Star game, whether they've been keeping these things. But as Evan Roberts is saying on the fan, well, that's because we don't live in the same television universe we lived in 25 years ago when there weren't that many options. And you could
yeah.
DVR the game, and you don't have to watch it in real time.
Right, right.
Or at all.
Yeah, no, you could just watch the 13-minute, I don't know if they have it, I have to check my iPhone, but you could check out the condensed version on your iPhone if you have the MLB at bat and get the point.
Yeah.
I've never been into All-Star. I gotta tell you, I'm just never in NBA. I did, you know, when I first started watching these leagues in the late 80s, I'd be into them a little bit. But I don't think I've gotten into any All-Star game in, you know, maybe since the Dream Team. You know, that's what I'm thinking about, the Dream Team in 92. I mean, that was probably like the last All-Star team that I was into. And, you know, I don't know. I just don't feel it. I'm not a proponent of this one counts. The players were into it. You could tell that yesterday. But, you know, the managers didn't manage exactly like it was a winner-take-all type of thing. So, you know, I don't know how you know, people are into it. I don't know how much they're into it. That could also be the ratings factor.
Well, I was into it because I wanted the National League to win one because I'm getting a little sick of this. And
sure.
And the other part of it was that I was interested to see, you know, to me, Charlie Manuel was very strategic in the way he played it, where Joe seemed to be on autopilot, Girardi. And, of course, it came back to bite him in the ass when Ortiz gets thrown out at second in the ninth inning. There were so many rules that I wasn't even aware of, the reentry rule and the double catcher rule, weird things, to avoid a tie, the embarrassment of a tie. And I just, it's one of those games now because of the fact that you've got a lot of the, you know, PEDs out of the game that were making, you know, the sport lean more towards pinball. And now you've got pitchers throwing, you know, starters throwing one inning.
Right.
You know, basically just ram back and fire it, and you got a lot of really quick innings. You got a lot of 9-10 pitch innings, which is also good for TV because they could double up on the commercials. And they got off the air in a little over 3 hours. So
there's also the lighting too. I think with the twilight, I think it was.
Oh yeah, that was the other aspect too. That I guess Pujols was talking about a little bit. But you compare that to the icing, the bells and whistles stuff, which the Home Run Derby on Monday night completely flat jumped the shark. Just like the dunk
right.
contest in the NBA
yeah,
does.
I agree. It's boring.
These things have become, because of the fact that we deal with a video game culture that always, you know, basically emphasizes the extremes, the emotional extremes, when to sit there and watch people hit home runs for 2 hours, batting practice home runs. Now, I know the Yankees broadcast their batting practice every night like it's something important. But it's become – like, I used to get to the ballpark early to watch, you know, growing up, you know, watch Dave Kingman hit home runs, things like that.
Yeah, I'm not into it anymore. I got to be honest with you. I don't watch batting practice. I don't care. I'm about the 9-inning game, and if I really want to be entertained, the manager's press conference, I don't listen to anything else. It's just a waste of my time. There's nothing – it's a point, too, with all the information out there. You know where your brain gets teased, where you're going to learn. And it's not going to be in those things, and maybe it's taken away from the enjoyment of the game in some aspect of it. But I'm more of a hey, let's get to the business. There's a 9-inning game, and you know, let's hear what you know, Joe and Jerry have to say because there's always a pearl of wisdom coming out of their mouth.
Yeah, pearl. Yeah, it's a pearl.
That you know you could you know focus in on, and you know if there's a player, you know usually when I listen to a player talk, it's to criticize, not to praise. You know, because they're not going to say anything. So, yeah, I could see that. And, you know, the whole stat fan thing, I think, really, the late 90s fantasy baseball came into vogue, and I jumped in on it, and there's a lot of young kids in their early teens that jumped in on it, and now they're in college, and they're ruling the world because, you know, they know everything, and apparently they know how to run a team, and this is how to do it. And,
Well,
you know, when the wheels of industry finally, when the wheels of industry finally teach them what reality is, I guess, you know, they could come back and don't say, I told you so. That's all.
Yeah.
I could say.
Well, this is another byproduct of the attention deficit stuff I was talking about before with the gaming industry's done to our brains, is that if you have one of those Dilbert jobs, and you've talked about it before in the show, that the corporate mentality of basically use them up, spit them out, you know, get them stuck in the system so they
can't
leave.
In a box. They call them meetings in a box. They want your job to be in a box. Here's how you're going to do it. You're on the assembly line. You just don't know it. It's really what we're
doing. Well, you don't matter. You're just a cog filling in this role. So when you have that as your template, you're going to look for distractions and diversions that you can do alongside that. So, yeah, the godlike power of running a fantasy baseball team is way more compelling. And that movie Fantasyland that I watched a while ago online, you know, attracts this guy that's a trader that's basically trading, you know, money on one hand. Of course, the government's watching porn with our money, but this guy's making trades on his fantasy baseball team, you know, during his time at work. And it's that mentality of always having another task running underneath, another subtask running, to keep you interested and compelled, because reality is just not enough anymore. I think we're at that point where you have a game that's basically from, you know, the 18th century, right? That we've souped up and you know, flipping around, watching a little of the Cyclones game before. That's about where it was when it started, like at the Cyclones level. And we've made it into, you know, all these new stadiums, they've made it into they call it a fan experience, right?
Right.
Where the game becomes sort of tertiary to the experience, because you're coming there for the food and then the gizmos and the gadgets and it's so much because they want to draw the family dollar in, because that's four people instead of one, and you know, douse them in alcohol, feed them a bunch of souped up food, and maybe they'll watch the game. Now, if you're going to try and actually engage and participate as a fan, I mean, I grew up basically sitting there watching my dad score. You know, I was like, that was what you did at a game. You sat there and scored, and he cursed at Cranepool. That was pretty much what happened. And now you have a situation where I don't know if the next generation of baseball fans, because of the fantasy attraction, because of the stat, you know, sort of bias, you know, I don't know if the baseball card thing is enough. I don't know if the relationship.
Well, they're not gonna like players unless they're statistically desirable. I mean, Jeff Francoeur, I think in another era, as much as he's flawed and he drives you crazy, there would have been a certain amount of charm to him. You know, these are a bunch of guys that if they were around in the 80s, probably would have hated Mookie Wilson, would have hated Wally.
Would have hated Wally, yeah. They would have hated Lenny. You there? Mike has been murdered. Uh-oh. We lost Mike. Hopefully he'll call back. That was interesting. So anyway, Mike was just summing up his thoughts there. He just went off the air. But yeah, well, I think that's the point I'm trying to make here, is that we dehumanized the relationship between fan and player. We've definitely done it between player and owner, and overall, all of it, we've dehumanized the relationship between the public and the media that covers it, because all these fourth walls have kind of collapsed, and the more they collapse, and the more the world flattens out in sports, just like it flattened out in politics and it flattened out in entertainment, and it's flattened out in other industries, healthcare, education, politics, we talk about a lot of them, we have to substitute a hamburger helper reality in there to kind of like restart the fire. So whether it's going to be fantasies and stats and things like that, or it's going to be scandals, you know, and innuendo and gossip and TMZ stuff and gotcha stuff, or it's going to be cheating and, you know, and steroids, this is what drives the engine now, the gossip and the right-brain kind of side story and the geeky, statty kind of like dry stuff. The two extremes on that Steinbrenner spectrum I talked about before is really what I'm getting at with this stuff. And the charm or the romance or the, you know, the need to sort of like actually have an experience or a bond with your team is kind of done over. We're not going to get back there. We have much more relationship with personalities than we do with teams now. That's why you'll follow LeBron down to Miami. You'll follow A-Rod around. You know, you'll follow all these people because of the fact that, A, you can make some money off them if you're playing the games, you're gambling, and, B, because they drive the media more than the team does. You know, when the end of the game comes and Sterling goes, the Yankees win. No, Yankees win. It's the Yankees that win. He doesn't say Jeter won or A-Rod won or Rivera won. It's the team. And as, you know, Seinfeld often says, you're rooting for laundry. And that sort of practice, I'll call it, that sort of a cultural behavior is a fast-fading thing because the affiliation between me and the team is something that is installed early on. It's called deep trans-identification, a technical term. But basically, early on in life, you get a set of things that dad approves of, whatever, that's going to indoctrinate you in the sports world, maybe mom, and you have an experience with that team, and you put on their colors, and you join the tribe. And that could be, you know, for your baseball team as much as it could be for your religion, your political party, your lifestyle habits, the way you dress. All that stuff is socially conditioned. Biology has nothing to do with it. Biology just supports it or rejects it, and that's really what we got. This is weird. So Mike's not there. Unless his phone crapped out on us. I don't see him. Maybe he joins us again. I wanted to go over this Strat-O-Matic game we did. He did it on his air before. Hopefully he'll call back. And we'll get him in. Let's see if he's emailed me or whatever. If he's had technical difficulties. Because it's Gremlin night. It's definitely been Gremlin night here at the stadium. Get your Gremlins here. Unbelievable stuff. I got to admit, when you do a BTR show week to week, if I've done for 3 years, pretty much everything that could possibly happen to a human being while he's on the air. Like, if I ever did a real radio show, if I was a real radio show, I wouldn't know what to do it myself, because, like, I've heard the phones, you know, crap out on talk radio before, but they have an engineer that fixes it. I have no way of calling Mike and getting him back on the air. I'm on the phone. I can't go, hold on, folks, let me go call Mike. I'm sure his phone just crapped out. He's in a dead zone. I don't know where he is. But he's not calling back. So we're on the air at 10:30. If you guys got any reaction to this you want to talk about real quick, 646-478-4847, 646-478-4847. Just want to go over the couple things coming out of the discussion with Mike, and maybe we'll get to this little somatic review of tonight's Strat-O-Matic game that we played. Wanted to segue to that right before he died on me there. Let's see if he's in the chat room or somewhere. Where are you, Mike? Nope, I don't see you. Well, I'll be hanging out over here, see if you call back. Anyway, looking out at the world here, coming into the second half of July, second half of baseball season, and also sort of that middle third of the summer between 4th of July and Labor Day. A lot of vacations, right? A lot of sort of brains going to the other side of the dial. And I just want to know, what's the engine of that energy that allows us to go into a different persona? Because our summer persona, culturally, it's actually the opposite of what it should be biologically. We should be in the growing season. We should be adventuresome and doing things that we've never done before, be almost in a state of extreme novelty. Most of us are looking to lie flat on our backs like lizards on a rock. And then in the wintertime, when we should be kind of, you know, in stillness and reflection and sort of internal, we're traveling all over the place for the holidays. It doesn't, you know, I never understood that. Checking out the ESPYs here. Sean White just got an award. He's looking very carrot top tonight. So maybe check in on that for a second. I don't think Mike's going to make it, folks. But this ESPY award thing is kind of goofy. I can't relate to it. I just can't. You know? I mean, again, the entertainment part of sports, anything that we could do to make sports look like Hollywood, because that gets you into sort of, that, like I said, that personality-driven or that, you know, sort of persona type of motif that you can do so easily in movies. But you mix the comedy in, you mix the music in, you mix the that movie star mentality in, and you get them next to the sports star, and the sports star thinks that they are. LeBron James thinks he can be Jay-Z, right? these guys equate that. That's where the power is behind all this stuff. It's in that sort of, you know, being an iconoclast, being larger than life, being Steinbrenner, being someone who transcends his arena. And so when you say Brett Favre, you say Jeter, or you say any one of these guys' names, they are like share. They are one-word names. They are cultural kind of touchstones that you can get into. And the sort of the mixed message is, well, you could be just like them. No, you can't. But buy their shoes, drink their drinks, you know, go to their games, buy their paraphernalia, you know, buy their jerseys. All those things are there. And because of that, we're, you know, we're sort of in that motif where we're being sold something. And Mike touched on it a little bit. He's a very hard sell when it comes to baseball. He knows when he's being manipulated by the game. He knows when he's being goaded into things by the stat geeks on his site. And if you guys aren't familiar with Mike's site, it's NewYorkBaseballDigest.com. Unbelievably thorough site. And like I said, Howard McDowell is actually running for the GM of the Mets against Omar all summer long and getting you know, voted on from the blogosphere. So I guess we lost him. I guess his phone crapped out. Doesn't look good for Mikey. I'm looking for Mikey. See if he's made it over to Facebook to tell me. I don't see him. Yeah, I think that's going to be it for Mikey. I'm going to have to go over this summer recap on my own here and send him a clip. So, we'll see. Check on the Facebook. Dun, dun, dun. Let's see. All right. Comments. There's nobody here. So I guess Mike is offline, as they say. Brother. All right. Well, if Mike calls back in, we'll include him. But let's go over this Stratomatic game that happened earlier tonight. See if we can mix in the last piece at the end and get out of here by 10:30. That's the goal. All right, so just to go over it, Mike had the all-time Yankees against the all-time Mets. Viernes. Okay? Sorry. In a Stratomatic game played earlier tonight on NewYorkBaseballDigest.com, the Yankees starting lineup consisted of five Philos. They had four Antos, three Ecos, and eight Exos. The starting lineup had Posada, Anto, Mattingly, Exo, Cano, Anto, A-Rod, Philo, Jeter, Derek Jeter, Ananto, Matsui, Exo, Mickey Vanto, a Philo, Reggie Jackson, an Eco, Jason Giambino, a big Philo, and on the mound, Ron Guidry, Exo Face, from 1978. I think that was the 25-3. Version of him. So anyway, there's your Yankee lineup against the Mets, which featured four Philos, three Antos, nine, count them, nine Ecos on this Met lineup, and four Exos who played prominent roles in the game. All right, so the starting lineup, we had Piazza and Exo, Olerud at first base and Exo, Edgardo Alfonso, and Anto at second base, David Wright and Reyes, the two Philos on the left side of the infield, Cleon Jones, the Eco in left, Darryl Strawberry, the Eco in right, and Carlos Beltran, 2006 Carlos Beltran, the healthy knees, the Exo in center. Bernard Gilkey was your pinch hit, your designated hitter, and on the mound, Doc Gooden before the rehab in 1985. So the game played out pretty much without a lot of fits and moves. As far as the bench players go, which was interesting because the bench players had a lot of Ecos on the Mets. I think only Hernandez got in the game as an Eco replacement for Olerud, who got hurt. And you guys can probably check it out at NewYorkBaseballDigest.com. We'll put the box score up. But basically, the highlights, the attendance was 43,183. let's see. I'll give you kind of a... Gooden pitched well for New York in their victory, surrendered seven hits and two walks in nine innings, and surrendered four home runs. So the Yankees got all their runs. They were all four solo home runs, I think so. Guidry really pitched kind of wild. He held up nine hits. He had three walks in five innings. And basically the Mets, the way the game pretty much went was Mets got a run on the top of the first, double by Reyes, single by Olerud, and that got the first run home, so you got a little Reyes run there. The Yankees countered with Jeter getting a walk, and then Mattingly hit a two-run homer, so there's two of the runs. Because it was 9-5, right? Okay, there you go. So there you go. They did score all their runs on home runs. So 2-1 Yankees early. The Mets got a run in the second. Let's see. Looks like a double by Wright, a fly out, a double by Alfonso, knocking him in. And the Yankees come back with a home run by Matsui in the bottom of the second. And then we go all the way to the bottom of the fourth when the Yankees got went ahead 3-1 home run. Let's see. Bottom of the fourth was the monster shot by Reggie leading off the inning. See, but, you know, Gooden kept basically getting a lot of these solo shots, and the Mets had some rallies going. So here you go. Now you got it. It's 4-2 Yankees, top of the fifth inning when the Mets explode, top of the fifth, with Reyes comes on with a flyout, then Olerud walks, Beltran walks, he hits Piazza. So the Mets load the bases on two walks and a hit by pitch. And Strawberry comes up, the Eco, and hits a Strawberry-esque home run down the right field line. And there's your four runs, and the Mets had to stay at that point. The Yankees did come back with a run in the eighth, but the Mets actually tacked on three in the sixth inning on a home run by Cleon Jones, a single by Reyes, and then a home run by Beltran. So a lot of home runs in this game. And, you know, it was weird because when you look at it, you know, with the Yankees having all these exos, especially Guidry, and yet exo versus exo, you had the two exos pitching against each other, and one kind of breaking down and not being able to correct, which is a core exo signature, if you guys study the somas at all. Now, their nervous systems are very task-oriented, so when they go offline, it's like a wrong number just gets redialed faster and faster. And Mike's gone. So that's the way that went. So anyway, I wanted to talk to him a little bit about that because if you look at this, you know, on paper, you see the stats and you'd say, wow, look at all these Yankees, you know, Mickey Mantle, Reggie Jackson, you know, Jeter, A-Rod, you know, these are all timers against these Mets, which, you know, outside of say Strawberry and Piazza, you know, not a lot to write home about, and yet because the way that inning went, the way it broke down for them, Strawberry coming up in the pressurized situation. Anytime you get an emotional, you know, crest, the eco is going to beat the exo. When you get a more of a logical trough, where it's basically just like, you know, drilling nails, the exo is going to excel. And that's really what happened with Doc. He got double plays behind him. Alfonso Dianto, the lone Anto in the starting lineup. You know, one of the few on the Mets. They only had Mazzilli and McDowell. The only other two Antos there. You know, to kind of be the natural leaders in the game. And Alfonso put his stamp on the game with, you know, double and a couple of double, made a couple of good, great defensive plays. And that was it. That was all it took to broke to break the seal once Guidry blew up. And, you know, there you go. There's your Strat-O-Matic game. But there's a lot of somatic stuff underneath it that I wish we could have talked about with Mike. But, you know, oh, there he is. Wow. You're back.
Little phone problem, my friend.
Just a little. Well, we were talking about,
you know, the iPhone 3G with the
yes.
upgrade. It just
yeah, the
it
antenna
was searching.
Problem.
It was searching, and I didn't have your number. I had to program the phone. I had to restart it, and I
oh my god,
for all that.
No problem.
Yeah, I think one of the Saber guys got into
yeah,
the line.
You got geek sap there. Yeah, we were talking about
yeah.
the beginning of the show how the technical world. You know, because it's so new and so sort of raw that it's about as unreliable as humans. And, you know, it sort of like forces us into a lot of coping skills that we just don't need to have as carbon-based little organisms here. But I don't know if you caught it, but I was reviewing the game, you know, that you played earlier on New York Baseball Digest,
mm-hmm.
the Strat-O-Matic game between the Mets
right.
and the Yankees. And basically what I wanted to ask you was is that knowing the result now, looking back at it,
mm-hmm.
the key matchups to me, based on the way the teams were designed, was the Mets – typical Mets were mostly eco, mostly a bunch of emotional, you know, kind of
right.
crest, you know, fish or foul kind of players,
right.
and the Yankees were the methodical, you know, more of the Onto XO kind of taskmasters.
Oh, it was an incredible lineup, but I was putting those, and the fans voted in the starting lineup, and I was looking at the lineup. So lefty base, not surprising. Picked the new stadium, which is, you know, statistically just from the ballpark factors. I mean, there's a fly ball going out there that has a chance at a home run. You got 3 in 4 chances going to go out. That's how great it is, because that's based on the – but that's also based – and that's where this thing gets kind of tough to – from a realism standpoint. You're taking a lot of different factors statistically from different years and blending them together into this pot. So, you know, Doc Gooden can't be expected to perform at the same high level against that lineup that he would have against the 1985 National League. Because, hey, 9 innings, 5 runs against that lineup with a 5 ERA, I think that's pretty good.
I was going to say, you know, and
I think that's pretty good. And, you know, it's and the main lineup wasn't a slouch either. Wasn't as good, but it wasn't a slouch lineup either, to be perfectly honest. So.
No, I thought the game pretty much, you know, in the middle innings was where it kind of spilled over to the Mets side, and it all blew up for Guidry in one inning when he walks two guys and hits Piazza. And Strawberry, typical Strawberry, like Reggie, comes on the stage and takes advantage. And to me, that was reality. And I just found that the defensive stuff was the stuff I couldn't have because, again, most stats are more on the offensive side, pitching side.
Right.
Yeah, when you see the great defensive plays that the Mets made, Beltran makes a diving catch in the outfield, Alfonso makes a couple plays up the middle that would have been
a
big situation.
Yeah, that was big, you know, those two hits go through.
Oh, yeah, the Yankees are business.
First and third, nobody out.
Oh.
I think it was 9-4 at the time. You know, Gooden's pitch count gets up at that point.
So you
get
that Met bullpen,
you know,
it's over.
It's not a bad bullpen. I mean, I think you were thinking of Jesse. You were thinking of the real value of that bullpen was in Hosco with that 83 season. If you go back to the encyclopedia, look at 83, it's tremendous. I mean, Benitez 99, you're thinking Benitez, but Benitez 99, these are statistically great guys. Now, you know, we're thinking of it, like you said, from the personality standpoint, can Benitez handle Yankee Stadium? The game isn't necessarily going to look at that aspect, but it will factor in clutch ratings, which are derivatives of numbers that are derivatives of personality stuff that you talk about that no one wants to. So even though those are numbers we're dealing with, those numbers were generated from people, and those people have personalities. So I guess you could see that there might be some of that. There's home field. There's a special sauce in there. It has a home field, and, you know, tell you what, they didn't get that double play in the ninth inning. It would have been interesting to see if a couple runners get on.
Well, I would say, if you're not good now in the eighth or ninth, I think we're still playing, because the Yankees were playing long ball the whole game, and I don't want to see it. Do you want to see Benitez come up against Reggie or Mickey or
I don't A-Rod? Think that Davey, with three lefties in that bullpen, I would hope that Davey wouldn't have done that. I hope that Davey would have.
Davey was going to ride
good
to the end.
Although Franco is a possibility, too. So.
Oh, God, dead fish. That's all we need is a dead fish.
It
would have
been interesting
up there.
Yeah, I mean, just the lineup, and Mattingly, I think, was out of those guys, probably the best pure hitter out of all of them. And, you know, Mickey Mantle was in there at the end of his career, still putting up big numbers. But I think the score, I think if that game was played at Citi Field, it would have still been a high-scoring game for Citi Field fans, but I think you would have been looking at a 6-4 game.
Maybe those right field home runs would have been caught. It might have been high enough
to
hit the Pepsi Forge, who knows?
Yeah,
but,
you know, that was
to me, what I'm interested in now is, if now we played this game, is if you had an all-time Met killers against the Mets and an all-time Yankee killers against the Yankees, you know, more like, you
well,
know.
I've been thinking
like
of a couple of things. You know, I mean, I kind of starting to, so it was this experiment I did. I didn't know how it was going to work. I was a little concerned about the play-by-play aspect because it was a little tough for me.
You got to get that.
You got to remember something. I have a play-by-play. I have a generic play-by-play that's giving me facts in front of me that I have to turn on the money into results and descriptions.
Yeah. And
not that I was making stuff up,
which is great.
You know, exactly. Yeah. But it's basically telling me, hey, Alfonso just made a great play up the middle. And it gives me a few facts. It gives me some description, but not to the point where it'd be an interesting text. So I was almost doing that real time. It was pretty much in real time. And I didn't take a drink the entire, was it 70 minutes?
Hey, you did it all with Vin Scully. You did it all by yourself.
I listened back a little bit. I could have done it better. I did do the Sterling call on the Beltran home run.
Yeah,
and,
that was great. You've got
that was great
that
because the system confused me because Reggie went back to play the ball off the wall. And when I saw that, I took my eye to look up at something where the ball was going. And apparently the ball disappeared on the screen and it said it off the wall, when in reality, when I saw him turn his back, I said, oh, that thing's gone. And, oh, that thing's off the wall. It's in to play it, and the thing was gone. So,
even in the Stratomatic world of 2010, you still have some of the glitches in the program that... I mean,
yeah.
I played dice baseball. I never have the patience for Stratomatic.
And this is really derivative of dice. I mean, Hal Richman, I mean, the six columns, three columns on a hitter's card, three columns on a pitcher's card, you get a 50-50 shot. Hey, listen, if you hit more Gooden columns than hitter columns, you probably would have had a lower scoring game. And I think that's what you saw later in the game, that the advantage went to the Gooden. Because when you roll that dice and it says, okay, go by the hitter's column, and there's lefty-righty splits, by the way. It's not just a generic card. Wow. It's broken down into lefty-righty. That's why you saw guys like Righetti get brought in to turn Beltran around and stuff like that. And, you know, you have guys who can't hit lefties, and they're not going to hit lefties in that game. You know, that's the beauty of it. I'm playing it for, like, 20-something years. And I think the next thing I'm going to do, and it's probably not going to be right now, but kind of revisiting what we did in the past with What If and also with some Stratomatic, is to do this with actual teams from different seasons, like the Big Red Machine versus the Yankees, or the Mets of whatever season versus the Yankees of a season, and actually do this seven-game series over the course of maybe a week and see if people actually like listening. Because I didn't know how that was going to play out, and I guess I'll be curious what people's feedback is over the next few days.
Yeah, it's a good hot stove idea to do, you know, between Thanksgiving and the winter meetings, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, 70 minutes is a long time, but if you're on, I don't know, I think you can't, from listening for a five-minute clip, I think I think I kept it flowing pretty well.
No, if anyone wants to listen to it, it'll be up on his site tomorrow if it's not up already.
You can click on it now. I don't think I put the download up yet, but you could click on the live link and you can
go listen to it back on BTR and like I said, you'll be able to check it out, because to me it was a great use of the Wednesday after the All-Star game, and I enjoyed the hell out of it, because you know I have a rooting.
Yeah, I think people were getting into the drama aspect of it. You know, is my team going to win? And you know, I think Mets fans get more into this stuff than Yankees fans, to be honest.
We have to settle for fantasy, because reality is too painful. So. Yeah. Well, thanks for calling back in, Mike. I'm going to have to wrap it
no
up.
No problem.
Here,
I'm sorry for the gremlin, and I'm glad you enjoyed the game, and we'll chat.
Yep.
All right.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for joining us again. All right, there goes Mike. And I will leave you now to go back to my day job with a little more RBI from Game 6.
Tension mounts some more. Two out in the 10th. 5-4 Red Sox. Ray Knight at first. Kevin Mitchell at third. 2-2 to Mookie Wilson. Coming over, he will not have a play. 5-5 in a delirious 10th inning. Line drive foul. Can you believe this ball game at Shea?
Oh, brother.
So the winning run is at second base with two out, 3-2 to Mookie Wilson. Little roller up along first, behind the bag. If one picture is worth 1,000 words, you have seen about 1,000,000 words. But more than that, you have seen an absolutely bizarre finish to Game 6 of the 1986 World Series. The Mets are not only alive, they are well, and they will play the Red Sox in Game 7 tomorrow.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. Spiral on, Sapiens. We'll see you next week, 9 o'clock, for more Zoom-a-time. Be yourself and be well.